Joseph M. Ashley, a doctor of rehabilitation and nationally recognized industry leader who is blind, brings a personal commitment and over 30 years of leadership in developing services and creating opportunities for individuals with disabilities to support their choice to live, work, and thrive in their communities.
Hello, and welcome to The Blind Experience with Dr. Joe Ashley. Are you an individual who is blind or has low vision and you're curious about what services, new information, activities, or other types of services might be available to improve your life experience? Or are you an individual who has a family member or a friend who is blind or has low vision and you're curious about what might be out there to help their life experience? With this new podcast series, we hope to create an opportunity for you to learn more about these services, resources, and whatever might be available to improve the blind experience. To accomplish this, we'll be discussing and examining resources, services, and issues related to the blind experience with individuals who are experts in the field, and many of whom are blind or have low vision themselves. So whether you're an individual who is blind and having some issues or just curious, or an individual who is going through a diagnosis at this time, or dealing with the issues of a degenerative eye disease, or otherwise just curious about the blind experience, hopefully you will find something in these discussions that will benefit you. I'll be bringing my perspective as an individual who was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa while in college and lost vision gradually until the age of 40, where I became totally blind. The podcast will use this personal frame of reference to examine the blind experience, providing information that will enhance the ability of individuals who are blind and vision impaired to live, work, and thrive in their communities. So let's get started. This is Joe Ashley with the Blindness Experience with Dr. Joe Ashley, and I'm here today with my guest, Colleen Miller, who is the Executive Director of the Disability Law Center here in the Commonwealth. Colleen has a varied experience in working in advocacy and protection for individuals with disabilities. She has been a lawyer with the ADA Center that turned into the Disability Rights Center with the Department of Justice, and has had a role in the state of New Mexico in their protection and advocacy. Here in Virginia, she leads our state entity that is responsible for protection and advocacy. It has a variety of authorities that allow it to advocate, and also has a requirement that they work on the protection of individuals with disabilities who are being provided services within the Commonwealth. The remedies that the Disability Law Center can pursue include advocacy, litigation, and other administrative types of remedies that seem appropriate to whatever is being addressed. It's a very important agency for those of us who have disabilities, and I don't know that we fully understand what its responsibilities and how it can be useful to folks to ensure that they have the ability to live, work, and thrive in their communities. So we're just delighted to have Colleen with us today. Later, we're going to talk about the Virginia Ballot Initiative or Absentee Ballot Initiative for individuals who are blind who want to vote. But first, I'd like, Colleen, if you would please explain what the Disability Law Center is and what it does.
I would be happy to do that. And thank you so much for having me on your podcast today. So the Disability Law Center of Virginia is a nonprofit organization. We're about 6 years old at this point. We used to be a state government organization, but we are now fully independent of the state. We are statewide. We work in all parts of the Commonwealth, and we work with all kinds of disabilities, communication disabilities, physical disabilities, mental health, intellectual and developmental disabilities, every kind of disability that you can imagine. Which, as you might know, there's roughly 1 million people with disabilities in Virginia, and that's a little bit more than we can handle one on one. So we do try to address issues systemically. We try to represent individuals to protect their legal rights, but we try to identify legal rights where fixing it for one will fix it for thousands. And that'll be true, I think, as we talk about some of the election-related work that we've been able to do this year. We are a legal rights organization. We're not case management. We're not a service provider. So our job is to protect people's federal and state legal rights and to promote greater and greater legal protections for people, which we do through policy work, through legislative initiatives. And again, we're trying to do this on a very, very systemic basis, trying to fix it for as many people as we can.
So you've got a broad portfolio in front of you where you're making sure that their legal rights are protected and that where there's an opportunity or a requirement or a need, I would say that somebody that where you can affect something for one person that might help a lot of people, that's where you put your energy, sounds like.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Well, could you tell us a little bit about the Virginia ballot initiative that's out there right now? And I think it'll be useful for people who are looking for the June 8th primary. And I think it allows people who are blind or vision impaired to use an absentee ballot that they can mark themselves.
Yes, that's right. That's right. This issue came to us a little more than a year ago when the state was beginning to close down so much in response to the coronavirus, and had a conversation with the leader of an organization for people who are blind, and he said, you know, we're hosed. We are never going to be able to participate in the political process at this point because none of this is going to be accessible to us voting absentee, which is at that point, where we were all headed. We were all expecting to vote absentee in the primaries last year, in the general election, local elections. And so we started to work with the Department of Elections, trying to get some kind of solution on a friendly basis without having to get very threatening. And the problem was that absentee balloting is controlled by state law, and the Department of Elections just simply didn't have a whole lot of flexibility about how to make voting accessible to people with disabilities. You might remember even a year ago that if you wanted to vote absentee because of a disability, you had to actually state that on your application, what your disability was. Governor Northam,
yes, I've been there.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Right. Well, we had experience over the years where local registrars would just decide that was not a good enough disability and would deny you an absentee ballot. Well, so the law for that changed in July a year ago, where people could vote absentee for any reason at all. They didn't have to have a reason. And
what's interesting, Colleen, because, you know, in one county, I went in the county where I live, to vote absentee, and they had the earphones and everything I needed to vote by myself. If I go up to my precinct, they may have that, but getting it out and remembering how to use it, and it just
right.
I create a longer line, and it just feels uncomfortable to me. So
sure, yeah. Well, that's a really great observation on your part. The Disability Law Center has been out surveying polling places. We've been to hundreds of polling places over the last year and a half or so, and it's been interesting to see that in one county there's only one location that has the equipment that is accessible to people with vision impairments.
Oh my!
And so you have to find your way to the right location. Many times I would go to a location and ask to see their accessible equipment, and they'd point to a box in the corner. It's over there.
That's sort of what happened with me. They went over to the box and pulled out these earphones, and they said, well, I'm not really sure how these work.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So and I don't know that we've actually solved that problem. Mm-hmm. We do try to make kind of a big deal of it when we discover it and ask the polling places to train their staff on it. But, you know, they get new volunteers every year. And, you know, election officials change. So that's probably something we're going to have to do.
That's a continuing effort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to have to be. But absentee voting is a little bit different than using the accessible. Absentee ballots, you request the ballot. It is mailed to you. It is a particular shape that is has to be designed so that can be fed into a ballot reader. It's a particular texture of paper. You indicate on that ballot by using a pen, you indicate who your votes are for, and you have to then place it in a specially designed envelope, and you have to sign on a line on that envelope that you are the registered voter and you were the one that cast that ballot. So there's a lot of things in that whole process that are just simply not accessible to people who are blind or who have print disabilities. And that's what the advocacy groups who contacted us were really concerned about. Is how are we going to be able to vote absentee, especially if you are somebody who doesn't have a sighted person in your household to be able to help you to find the line or to mark the space.
Yeah, my wife went with me, and she had to sign some affidavit to be able to help me on those things.
Right. And, you know, what if you're living in a household where the sighted person has a different political persuasion than you do? How can you be sure that your family member is actually going to vote the way you've asked them to vote? So, and I'm sorry to say, I'm sure that exists in a lot of households. So we began to talk to the Department of Elections about this. They were not able to do anything voluntarily.
So they were sort of boxed in with their regulations.
Yeah, they sort of understood. But they said, first of all, that the technology was not there for them to be able to make independent voting accessible. And that even if it did exist, that they couldn't do it and comply with state law. So one of the things that's different about the Disability Law Center than most advocacy organizations is that we do have lawyers on staff, and we do have the authority to bring litigation when we need to. So we connected with a couple of private law firms and connected with the two major advocacy organizations for people who are blind, the American Council for the Blind and the National Federation of the Blind, and brought a lawsuit to try to get access for absentee ballots for people who are blind.
When you take the litigation forward, then you got, I think I saw a consent decree?
Yes, we prior to the November election, we got a consent decree on a preliminary injunction. So it was not a settlement for the entire case. But we got a settlement in place in time for the November election. And I think we got that towards the end of September. So there was enough time for us to get the word out to people about how to do it. And at that point, what the Department of Elections really did not believe that there was a secure and safe way for somebody to vote exclusively electronically. So what we agreed to do, and this ended up being the permanent solution too, was that a ballot would be could be sent by email, could be marked using screen reader technology, but it would then have to be printed and mailed back to the Department of Elections, or to the local registrar, I'm sorry. And the technique that we agreed to in the settlement agreement was that the local registrar would mail you an envelope, and the return envelope would be marked in a way that you could tell that that was the return envelope. And what's supposed to happen, and I think what happens, is that you have a conversation, an actual live, you know, over the telephone conversation.
People to people kind of thing.
Yeah. Who says, we're going to mail this envelope to you. There will be a marking on the upper right-hand corner, on the lower left-hand corner, wherever they've decided to. They tell you what the marking is going to be. And it could be a hole punch. It could be that the corner is snipped. It could be a braille marking, some kind of tactile sticker they refer to. But they will tell you, your registrar will say, here's what to expect. When you get that envelope, then you put your ballot inside of it and send it back. And you're supposed to sign somewhere on that envelope. It doesn't have to be on a special line or anything. It just signs somewhere on the envelope.
Wow. I think that's tremendous progress because I could, what you described, everything you just described, I could do.
Right.
And that's, right. That will be more fun. I do enjoy going up to the precinct up here and being a part of it, but I don't enjoy having to, you know, try and ask for the accessible stuff and then it's not there and it sort of mars the experience. So this would be easier. And probably
it would be easier,
faster for some people, the only way it's going to get done.
Right, right. And especially during the pandemic when so many people really did not want to leave their homes, stand in line, be in any kind of crowd, be around people that they just didn't know what kind of protection they would have.
Yeah, November would have been.
So we all, I think most of us, like the excitement of election day. Mm-hmm. We like to vote in person. We feel like there's a greater chance that our vote is actually going to be counted and not get lost in the mail. My advice to your listeners would be that if you are in a new precinct, to contact your local registrar in advance and say, you know, I'm going to be voting at the elementary school. I'm going to be voting at the library. And I need accessible technology.
Well, that's
please
a good
tell
idea.
Those poll workers to have it ready for me when I get there.
That's just too proactive. That's great. I hadn't even thought about that. I've been doing this.
You know, we wish that the poll workers would think about all of it in advance. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, like, those are volunteers, mm-hmm. and many of them are doing the best they can, and sometimes managing very, very large crowds. So a little bit of advance warning goes a long way, I think.
That's a great idea. And it seems like that would be an easier way to be sure you were going to be able to participate at the poll if that's your desire.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you can stand there and wait and insist that they set it up.
Yeah.
But that's going to take your time.
Yeah.
And as you said, in your experience, you've got a line building up behind you of people who are grumbling
about. Just isn't a good experience that way.
Right.
You have to have your cane out because everybody looks at you strange. I'm certain of it.
That's right.
Well, that's great advice. And I really appreciate you running down how this came to be. And it sounds like a really good step forward for us, for those of us who use screen readers to be able to vote from home.
Right.
If that's what we choose. That's a great thing to have as an option.
So just to sort of round out the timeline there, we got a temporary agreement prior to the general election in November. We came back to the negotiation table again this late winter, early spring, and got that solution agreed to for the primaries that are going to happen on June 8th. And simultaneously, the legislature then adopted all of those changes, and those changes are now part of Virginia state law effective July 1. So going forward, this agreement that was temporary back in the fall is now permanent in state law.
That's excellent.
Yeah,
that's, I guess that shows what happens when groups can come together and have a focused purpose.
Yeah, we were very lucky to be able to work with the National Federation of the Blind and the American Council of the Blind. I don't think that those two organizations work together often, but they were great partners with us in mm-hmm. this and gave us great advice along the way about what was going to work and whether solutions were going to be adequate or not.
Yeah.
We were really happy to
some good practical advice.
Yep.
That's excellent. But Colleen, if somebody's out there and they're not familiar with the organization, and they want to, and they think they may have an issue that they'd like to bring forward, how would that work for them?
Are you talking about the Disability Law Center? How they would
The Disability Law Center.
Yeah, this we try to make it as easy as possible. We do have an 800 number that people can call. That's 800-552-3962. And we are open regular business hours, Monday through Friday, where people can call during that time. We recognize that sometimes people are at their own jobs at that point and can't necessarily call. So you could either leave a message for us and we will try to get back, or you could also reach out to us on the web. So our website is dlcv.org, Disability Law Center of Virginia, dlcv.org. And on that site, there is a link to something that we call Get Help. So you can access that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and send in a request for help. Let us know how you would like for us to reach back to you. We try to reach back to you within a business day or two. So if email is your best tool for that or a phone call, you just let us know what works best and we'll read what you've sent us, figure out if we know enough to be able to help you. And if not, we'll call you back or send you an email back to try to set up some time where we can get more information to figure out what the best solution is.
That's great. Thank you for letting people know that. I think the organization that you lead has a tremendous value for the people with disabilities here in the Commonwealth. And I think some people just don't know how to access or that it's available to them. So I think it's important for them to understand that, because it can make a difference in their ability to be successful in their jobs or in their lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was hoping today we could talk a little bit about the new law that starts in July of 2021 that makes it so that the ADA requirements go down to an employer of 5. I think it was 15 before, and it's 5 now. I shouldn't be talking numbers because I'm not that familiar with everything. So if you could sort of explain this new requirement as of July 1, I think our listeners would be very interested.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. The Disability Law Center worked on this legislation very carefully with the Office on the Attorney General and also with Delegate Mark Sickles, who was the patron of this bill. So as we talked about the last time, the Disability Law Center represents people with disabilities all over the Commonwealth. We represent all disabilities, and there are far too many people with disabilities for us to represent one person at a time. So one of the things that we try to do is to try to make systemic change through policy work and through legislative changes. For many years, we've been representing people in employment discrimination claims and have been using the Americans with Disabilities Act because the protections are so good. Virginia had a disability discrimination law that was even older than the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that was called the Virginians with Disabilities Act. It was passed in 1984, so 7 years before the ADA was passed. And the ADA really learned from experiences in states like Virginia's. The problem is that the ADA is better than the VDA. It learned from some of the mistakes in the state laws, and the state law was never updated from that original 1984. So our state law in 1984 said that an accommodation is considered to be an undue hardship if it costs more than $500.
Oh my.
That was a limit that was set in 1984 and never changed. One of the things that we were happy to do this year was to update some of the provisions of the state law so that it was closer in line with the Americans with Disabilities Act. But let me tell you how that came about. A year plus ago, the Virginia legislature decided to update our State Human Rights Act, to offer protections to people of minority sexual orientations, the lesbian and gay and transgender community. And at that time, when they updated the Human Rights Act, they included people with disabilities in all aspects of that protection, except for employment. So people with disabilities were protected under the Human Rights Act for housing against housing discrimination, educational discrimination, public accommodations, but they did not include people with disabilities under the employment protections. The Attorney General's office notified us about this and said, you know, how can we fix this? So we started working together last summer around this time to figure out a legislative change to the law. The biggest problem that the legislators found when they were making the change prior to that was the conflict between the state law, the State Virginians with Disabilities mm-hmm. Act, and the federal law. And it just didn't seem obvious to anybody how to fix that conflict.
And that would, then employers would like it to be the same, I'm sure.
Right, right. So, but the state law had a very different definition of what a person with a disability was. Let me read it to you. Under a state law, and this is still true right now until July 1, a qualified person with a disability is somebody who's able to perform the duties of a job, but whose disability is unrelated to the duties of the job. So that would mean if you had a job, Joe, where your blindness was a benefit, that would make you not a qualified person with a disability. If somebody is deaf and communicates with people using sign language, they would not be a qualified person with a disability if that was a component of their job. It was kind of like a really weird, illogical definition.
Yeah, it'd be kind of hard to explain that.
Right, right.
In a way that people don't understand it.
Yeah, it was written at a time when our understanding of how people with disabilities could be employed was mm-hmm. really limited. You know, in the early 80s.
We didn't have near the technology.
That's right. That's right. We didn't have the technology. We didn't have the physical access.
The screen readers were just getting started.
Yeah. Our understanding of how could somebody possibly be blind and be a lawyer? You know, how could somebody possibly be deaf and be a bank teller? Mm-hmm. You know, we just really didn't have any of those ideas worked out yet. So I think that one of the big problems was things like, you know, the $500 limit. A weird definition of people with disabilities. I think that's why the legislature kind of like steered away from including people with disabilities in their first run at it. But we were lucky to work with the AG's office. They've got really smart lawyers there. I've got really smart lawyers on my staff. And we figured out some solutions. We recognized that it was going to mean that we had to do some updates to the Virginians with Disabilities Act. And we did. We updated the definition. We took out the $500 limit in the VDA. And there was also a really weird provision in the Virginians with Disabilities Act that said that an employer who hires somebody with a disability would not be liable for hiring somebody. Would not have any liability for hiring somebody with a disability. And Who knows what the thinking was when that was first included in the law.
That sounds like a circular argument there.
Yeah, yeah. It was very odd. We were able to add...
Somebody thought it was a good idea at the time, I'm sure, but...
Yes.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and we just never came back and revisited the state law on that.
Wow.
So we did go through the Virginia Human Rights Act and added disability into the employment protections. We were able to update the Virginians with Disabilities Act in a few provisions. There's still some work that needs to be done on that. The biggest difference, as you noted, between the state human rights law and the Americans with Disabilities Act is that the state human rights law applies to much smaller employers. There are parts of the law that apply to an employer who has only one employee. But the most comprehensive protections will apply to an employer with five or more. And the Americans with Disabilities Act applies to slightly larger employers, 15 or more.
Mm-hmm.
The other advantage, and we think it's a significant one, to the state law, is that if somebody has a complaint against their employer, they can file it with the Attorney General's office.
Oh, really?
The Attorney General's office has an office on human rights, and you can file a complaint with them, and it can be investigated so that you don't always have to hire an attorney. You don't always have to jump to the most expensive alternative to resolve things with your employer.
Okay. That sounds like it's a fairly comprehensive revision then.
It is, and there's some things that still need a little bit of work with the Virginians with Disabilities Act. I think we might give these changes a little bit of time to settle in mm-hmm. before we go back and try to get a more comprehensive fix. But the AG's office is talking to us about those already, so there's a possibility we will return to the legislature and ask for a few more cleanups even next January.
Well, that sounds excellent. That kind of work, I think, makes a big difference, and not everybody's going to appreciate the difference between the 15 and the 5, but
right.
the small businesses are really the ones that hire the most, I think, out there right now.
And in some ways, the small businesses can be more creative in
yes.
The ways that they accommodate people with disabilities.
Yeah, they yes. And so it'll be interesting to see what kind of impact it has over time. But just getting those definitions to be the same, I think, would be welcomed by the business community because it gets confusing to businesses.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the things that we talked to the leaders of the business community about, is that this is going to bring real clarity to your membership mm-hmm. about what it means to be a qualified individual with a disability.
And once they have the rules, it's a little easier for them to know what they need to do.
Right.
When there are conflicts between the rules that are out there, they get frustrated.
Right.
That's
right.
been my experience in the years that I worked in with employers on hiring and putting people with allowing people with disabilities to go to work.
And the business organizations that we spoke with were really familiar with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
I bet they
and
were.
So when we pointed out where the conflicts were and what we wanted to do, some of them were just sort of like scratching their heads saying, I already knew this. This is already what we do.
Yeah.
We had great support, actually, from the business community.
Well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
That's a good group to get behind you when you're trying to work these things through like this. Because.
That's right.
If it just can help them be clearer, then we have a better shot at getting good opportunities for people.
Yep. Yeah.
I do appreciate you taking the time to be back on the podcast, and hopefully we'll have some other things to talk about in the future.
I hope so. I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening in today on The Blind Experience with Dr. Joe Ashley. I hope you found some information that was useful to you, and we look forward to having you back again for the next episode.